This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of New Books Network. This is your host, Morteza Hajizadeh from Critical Theory Channel. Today, I'm honored to be speaking with Dr. Amy Letzter and Dr. Sonia Masai about a wonderful book they published with Cambridge University Press in 2023. The book is called Shakespeare at War, A Material History. Amy Letzter is a lecturer in English language and literature at the University of Oxford, and Sonia Masai is a professor of Shakespeare studies at King's College London. Amy and Sonia, welcome to New Books Network.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
It's customary to ask our guests first to briefly introduce themselves and tell us how they became interested in their area of studies. In your case, it's literature and more specifically Shakespeare. So it would be good to introduce yourself and then we'll talk about the book. So maybe Amy, we should start with you.
Thank you. So I work on Shakespeare, performance history, book history. I became interested in this area of study. I actually have a performance background. Very early years, started off as a ballet dancer, and this sort of transferred into an interest in literature and performance at university level. Since gaining my doctorate, I've mainly worked in early modern literature and drama. My first book was on history plays and how the publication process helps us understand what it means to write about the past alongside other discourses about the past. And then I've spent the past several years of my life on this wartime Shakespeare project, which is looking at the reception of Shakespeare over the centuries during periods of conflict. And in future projects, I'm hoping to continue my interest in historical discourses and writing about the past.
And I should say, first of all, I now have a double institutional identity. I moved my teaching and admin to Sapienza University of Rome, while I'm still affiliated to King's College London as a research professor. I should also say, since you asked, my passion for Shakespeare dates back to my university days, when I was still studying in Italy. I was taken to watch a production of Twelfth Night. It was the first time I heard Shakespeare being performed in English, and my English was still quite basic. I did not understand every single word, but I was completely taken in by the musicality of the language, the magic of that play, and I was hooked. The very next year, I was in the UK studying towards a PhD, and then I spent the next 30 years in the UK. I've only recently relocated to Italy, where I continue to study and research Shakespeare.
Wonderful. Thank you very much. So let's talk about the book. I'm keen to know why you decided to write a book called Shakespeare at War. And more important, the title is very interesting to me, a material history. What does that mean?
If I can maybe take that question first. So Amy and I became interested in this topic when we realized that other scholars had thoroughly investigated how Shakespeare represents war in his plays and poems. But no one had carried out a sustained investigation of how Shakespeare and his works have been used at times of war. So we realized that a reception history was needed. There wasn't one, not as yet. Other scholars had focused on the reception of Shakespeare during individual conflicts, most significantly during World War I. But we decided to focus instead on all major conflicts with a British involvement since Shakespeare's time in order to establish when Shakespeare was first mobilized and how uses of Shakespeare have changed over time. And the second half of your question as to why we called it a material history is due to the fact that we soon very quickly also realized that uses of Shakespeare have diverged quite significantly, and not only over time, but also within the context of a single conflict. So official uses of Shakespeare have, for example, differed quite dramatically from the way in which individuals have related to Shakespeare at times of great personal distress. And that's why we decided to focus on objects, on a wide range of material, archival objects that could help us do justice to the great variety of purposes that Shakespeare has served at times of war.
Yeah, and just to give a little bit more of a sense of how the material history is embedded within the collection, we have 26 different chapters and different contributors, and each contributor begins with a material object. So this could be a theatrical prop, playbill, a production photograph, a cartoon, a letter, or another kind of item. And they use that item as a jumping off point for then thinking about the use of Shakespeare in that context and within the context of the conflict in which that particular contributor is addressing. So it's this the sort of the beginning of each chapter is a discussion and description of a material object, which we have reproduced in color, glossy color image at the very beginning of each chapter.
Thank you. You sort of covered some of the other questions that I had before getting into the chapters, and I personally must say that reading the book, it was quite fascinating to me in terms of, well, there was of course a lot of Shakespeare scholarship there, but another level of education that I had was that you actually interview a lot of directors and you talk with them, and for me that was also quite interesting. I started checking these names to know what else they have done in this area, so I quite like the book in that terms as well. But can you briefly maybe tell us, I've got two questions, so I've just posed the two questions. So one of them is Shakespeare. Why Shakespeare is invoked more than maybe any other British authors in times of war? And then if this interpretation has it always been used to kind of gather people around the cause of the British wars or to create a sense of nationalism or patriotism, or maybe Shakespeare has also been used to criticize British involvement in some wars as well. So how has this interpretation changed over time? And why Shakespeare more than any other authors?
If I may, I
Shall I begin with this question, Sonia? Oh, yeah. Maybe I'll sort of start with a basic point, which is, I think it's quite odd that this 16th, 17th century playwright has become so linked to the discussion and the representation of conflict over the past 4 centuries, especially because Shakespeare's plays are, if not critical of conflict, then they're certainly equivocal about it. War brings political instability and suffering, civil unrest within Shakespeare's plays. It destroys families and livelihoods. Even a play like Henry V is probably the closest we get to a triumphant representation of conflict, but even that is not without its complexities. So I think why Shakespeare is used, or why Shakespeare has been used so consistently, it's something that happens beyond the plays themselves. And I think a lot of that can be traced maybe to the 18th century, which is a period that's marked by several major conflicts in which Shakespeare is used on a global stage, often but not exclusively in support of Britain's wartime aims. So I think the Seven Years' War is a really central conflict. This is 1756 to 63, and this is a time when Shakespeare in print and on stage has been used to support the aims such as the expansion and acquisition of colonies and empire. So I think why Shakespeare, it's not just what we have within Shakespeare's plays, it's how Shakespeare has been used. And this pattern has continued over the centuries. And I think a lot of Shakespeare's quite vocal users have mobilized him in support of Britain's wars and to commemorate war. We could talk about the First and Second World War, perhaps, in this context, and a few of the examples that we have within the collection. But I think what has been really important for both Sonia and I to stress within this collection is that there are also many more diverse views of Shakespeare's use as well, and that they're alongside uses that seem to support or commemorate conflict, there are also ones that are very critical, and that is something that is there from the very start of Shakespeare's use during periods of conflict. I think one of the things that I'm really interested in myself, and something that I've explored in a companion book as well, is sort of the issue of selection bias and documentary loss. The fact that if you want to find a narrative about Shakespeare's patriotic wartime use, then you can find it, but that's not the whole story. It's never been the whole story. Access to alternative histories is complicated, A, by the fact that critical accounts so far have tended to focus on Shakespeare as a morale-boosting, patriotic wartime figure. And secondly, I think by the fact that there's also a greater likelihood that these accounts have survived. I think those are some of the tensions and issues at play when thinking about how do we summarize, who Shakespeare is during periods of conflict over these centuries.
Sonia, you'd like to add something? Yeah.
Yeah, if only to say that what's most striking to me about the mobilization of Shakespeare at times of war is this, as Amy was saying just now, the interrelation of the kind of multiple perspectives that Shakespeare offers when it comes to war and the cultural capital that Shakespeare has accrued over the last 400 years. which make his plays and poems more familiar than any other body of work by any other author, past or present, which then makes the uses of Shakespeare eminently recognizable and therefore quite resonant and effective. And the multiple perspectives is something also very useful because you can mobilize Shakespeare to voice different opinions, different views about war, as much as about pretty much anything else, from love, friendship, the impact of death on a loved one, to the drive to power or the drive to resist tyrannical power. Shakespeare, maybe more than any other author I love and I'm familiar with, has the ability to produce a memorable character through arresting stage images or highly evocative language. Alas, poor Yorick. I knew him, Horatio, a fellow of infinite jest, of most excellent fancy. He has borne me on his back 1,000 times. Those lines for Hamlet evoke a past we do not share, a friendship that we had heard nothing about before these lines. And yet within a few seconds, we get a heart-wrenching sense of the friendship. And the same applies to war. One moment you read or hear that, and I quote, "The valiant never taste of death but once." And the next, next you hear that few die well that die in battle. So two opposite views, and they're equally resonant and equally memorable. That is the reason I think that Shakespeare has been used regularly, both by those who wish to justify and those who wish to critique all possible reasons for going to war. And just to finish that train of thought, as Amy put it quite eloquently already, the other reason why Shakespeare is quoted so often has to do with the historical circumstances that led to the rise of English as a world language, and the central role also played not just by Shakespeare, but also more recently by London and by British cultural institutions as world leading centers of cultural production. So Shakespeare is like a readily available currency, a shared language that allows artists, writers from around the world to engage in a conversation that kind of gives resonance to their interventions.
Let's talk about the first chapter of the book. And you've written this chapter, Sonia. So the truth for which we are fighting, David Garrick's The Tempest and Inclusive Britishness During 7 Years' War. And again, this was one of those educational pieces that I said that I talked about earlier, David Garrick, that I didn't know. So could you please briefly introduce him and his adaptation of The Tempest, and then talk about how this adaptation reflects the uses of wartime Shakespeare?
Yes, David Garrick was one of the most famous Shakespearean actors of his generation in the middle of the 18th century in London. He rose to instant popularity after he performed as Richard III at Goodman Fields, a theatre in Whitechapel, in October 1741. It was the natural style of his delivery that elicited a sensational response from audiences who had clearly got quite tired of a more stylized and formal way of performing Shakespeare. Garrick adapted The Tempest in late 1755, and this version of The Tempest opened at Drury Lane in February 1756. Garrick pared down Shakespeare's play quite radically by cutting down the number of characters and the number of lines in order to make space for 32 songs. Now, Shakespeare's Tempest is already quite musical. Some of the most memorable lines are about the power of music, to evoke a sense of place or mood. Sense of Tempest and memory of great productions of Tempest are linked to lines that really resonate, such as the isle is full of noises, sounds, and sweet airs that give delight and hurt not. But Garrick gave even a more central place to music in his adaptation of Tempest, so much so that it's often described as operatic. And he also wrote a dialogue that was performed as a prologue before his adaptation of Tempest, which also foregrounds the beauty and power of British music, as well as the power of Shakespeare to move, including the power of music and Shakespeare to raise belligerents' resistance to the possibility of a foreign invasion. This note of alarm was sounded on the eve of the outbreak of the Seven Years' War, a conflict that Amy has already mentioned, when major European powers sided with Britain or with France to establish their supremacy not only in Europe, but also over their colonies, mostly in North America and other parts of the world. So Garrick's Tempest was timely. The addition of the dialogue made sense in the context of this conflict, the outbreak of this conflict. But uncharacteristically for Garrick, this adaptation of Tempest was a flop. It did not prove popular with contemporary audiences. And that's probably due to the fact that Garrick nuanced and problematized the kind of jingoistic pitching of British interests against those of Britain's European neighbors. Rather than aspiring to become, and I quote from the dialogue, the terrors of Europe, as this acrimonious, vitriolic theatre critic puts it, Garrick, I suspect, tried to put across the message spoken by the sensible and considerate stage actor Hartley, who urges Garrick's audiences to stay true to their age-old principle of a British breast, which is to befriend those who are most oppressed. So it was a timely adaptation. It clearly engaged with the prospect of a European war, and did not prove popular with audiences who probably felt at that time the need to protect themselves from a possible French invasion. And the last thing I think I'm keen to mention is the fact that Garrick probably had also a personal reason for dreading the escalation of conflict between Britain and France. He was the grandson of French Huguenot refugee David de la Garrigue, who had fled Bordeaux in the south of France when the Edict of Nantes was revoked in 1685. The French Huguenots were then forced either to convert to Catholicism or to face life in prison. And so he had French origins. And so the prospect of a new war between France and Britain must have filled him with dread, and must have brought also back very bad memories of being hounded for sounding different, in this case not French, but from the Midlands, because he grew up in Staffordshire and never got rid of his Midlands accent, which was clearly at the time regarded as inappropriate to perform Shakespeare.
Thank you very much. And we have another chapter here, which you wrote, Amy. Hamlet mobilized political parody during the Napoleonic Wars. And then you talk about how uses of Shakespeare or his soliloquies were used both to show support and also at the same time sometimes to cast doubt or start debates about British involvement in war. Can you talk about that chapter, please?
Yes, of course. So just to give a little bit of context to start, the period of the French Revolution divided parliamentary and public opinion in Britain. There was widespread interest in political discussion, debating the merits of the revolution, debating Britain's response, and indeed the justification of wars against France in the early years of the conflict. And at this time, a lot of graphic satires, political parodies, caricatures were used on a huge scale as a form for political discussion and debate, and to explore a wide range of different perspectives on that. But as Napoleon rose to prominence, and there was a short-lived peace treaty that broke down, there was around about 1803 an outpouring of graphic satires and parodies that seemed to have much more of a clear take on the conflict, and that was to announce or promote support for Britain's defences against Napoleon, especially because at that specific point in the conflict, there was the threat of a French invasion on British shores. So what I focus on in this chapter is a spate of parodies that use Hamlet's famous "to be or not to be" soliloquy as their starting point, and I begin with a wonderful graphic satire that's written and designed by George M. Woodward, and it pairs a parody of this speech that's adapted for Napoleon, who's debating the merits of invading Britain. You know, to go or not to go replaces to be or not to be. And that's matched with a hand-coloured caricature of Napoleon, who's shown in an oversized hat, which is playing into contemporary satires of his supposedly small stature. And Woodward's prints typically advance pro-government, anti-French sympathies. This one is no exception. Napoleon's representation in text and image sort of work together to ridicule Britain's adversary at a time of growing concern over a threat of a French invasion. The way in which this soliloquy works is by trying to present Napoleon's actions as cowardly. I mean, maybe I can give a couple of lines to give a flavor of it. It begins, "To go or not to go, that is the question. Whether 'tis better for my views to suffer the ease and quiet of yon hated rival, or to take arms against the haughty people, and by invading end them. To invade, to fight, no more. And by a fight to say we end the envy and the thousand jealous pangs we now must bear with. 'Tis a consummation devoutly to be wished. To invade, to fight, perchance be beat. Aye, there's the rub." And that's just the first opening lines of this soliloquy, and the way in which it's working as a kind of propaganda in support of Britain's defences is by suggesting that Napoleon is debating whether or not to invade, but is going to be put off by the fear of losing. The rub is the fear of defeat. So it has a completely different application from and tone from the play itself. So gone are the deeply philosophical debates about self-slaughter that is within Hamlet's soliloquy. And in its place, we have a much more secular soliloquy that's focused on worldly gains. And I mentioned that this was part of a spate of soliloquies that draw on this speech. And they all appeared between about 1803 and 1805 in response to this renewed wartime context and the threat of invasion. They differ in terms of their strength of attack on Napoleon. Sometimes Napoleon is the target, sometimes it's France as a country as a whole. Sometimes Britain's war defences seem to be celebrated and presented in a confident light. But other times this soliloquy is used as a template for drawing attention to the suffering and the uncertainty of conflict. And it doesn't necessarily follow that these soliloquies, these parodies here of Hamlet's soliloquy reveal untrammeled optimism and confidence in Britain's war effort. This was also a work by social historians have explored. It was a period of high desertion rates in the army and militia. So it might be the case that these parodies actually testify to fractures in support and in Britain's confidence as well. One print that I could mention and which I've written about elsewhere is James Gilray's "The Plum Pudding in Danger," which shows Britain's Prime Minister William Pitt and Napoleon greedily tucking into this pudding, this plum pudding that doubles as a globe of the world, and it adapts a line from Shakespeare's Tempest, saying that everything that the world offers is not enough to satisfy such insatiable appetites. So suggesting that what might be seen as a defensive conflict actually on Britain's part might actually be quite a familiar conflict of territorial kind of conquest and expansion. So I think this is within the chapter that I look at. It's I'm very interested in the use of Shakespeare and the use of print and graphic satires as a forum for expressing different and diverse political opinions.
Thank you. I actually have a book of James Gilroy's drawings here, and I was going through that just looking at the pictures, and I came across that one again, but I never even bothered to actually read what's written there, so I just read the commentary. It's quite interesting you mentioned it again. And one good thing about the book is that, well, it has academic articles, but you also done some interviews, and the chapter 13 is an interview that both of you have conducted with Maggie Smelt. So can you tell us about her? And also, she had a production of Henry V in 2015, which was all female production, quite interesting. What did she aim to achieve by that? Can you talk about that play, please?
Of course. So Maggie Smales is a theatre director and performer, and we interviewed her specifically about the 2015 production of Henry V, which was at the Upstage Centre in York. This all-female production was set during the First World War, Maggie aimed to draw attention to the contributions, often overlooked contributions, made by women workers during the First World War. In this case, the Bombo lasses, the so-called Bombo lasses, who worked at the Bombo munitions factory outside of Leeds. This was a huge factory. It employed about 16,000 workers, and during the First World War, about 93% were women. Maggie used a parallel narrative structure within her production. So the play was set at a munitions factory, where we meet women who are working in the factory. And at the beginning of the play, one of these women receives a parcel, and in that parcel contains a jacket of a loved one and the news that they have died. And this this woman who had not been at that point marked out from the other factory workers puts on the jacket. This is actor at Claire Morley. And this is a moment of transformation, and Morley becomes Henry V. And at this point, Shakespeare's play begins. And what Maggie has developed is a production that has both, that has these parallel stories working together. We have the production of Henry V, but we also have moments of this factory life intruding at different stages. One of the moments that this is most prominent is in the scene of the Battle of Agincourt, which coincides in the factory world with an explosion at the factory. This is a historical explosion that killed and injured a lot of the women. This was sort of illustrates Maggie's aims with this production, which were specifically to draw attention to the sacrifices and the contributions that are not often commemorated, and that these women made during this conflict to help and assist Britain's war effort. Alongside that, there was also an interest in the ways in which this setting illustrates a collective transformation that happens for the women involved in the factory life and in war contributions. That as Claire Morley dons this jacket, it is her the workers around her give their support to her as a military leader in this other kind of context. So there's an emphasis on how as a group, we are all contributing to ideas of transformation during conflict, and it's not individual political leaders acting independently of that. Maggie was also, in a similar way, interested in how this is a production that was staged just a couple of years after the official end of the Iraq War, and that this production therefore also brings in another context, thinking a little bit about the female experience of war on a wider stage, and also about ideas of support for the war efforts when we're drawing on the Battle of Agincourt, on the First World War, on an aftermath of the Iraq War, and how you can often gain a sharper view of a collective response to conflict by perhaps not tackling it directly, you know, through this production. So it was really fascinating to discuss and work with Maggie on this. On her production, because it was really vital for her to draw attention to these stories of women's contributions that up to that point hadn't really been fully acknowledged.
And another chapter you have is chapter 19, which is again another interview with someone called Julia Pascal. So that, and the title of the book, the chapter is "Framing the Jew." Julia Pascal's the Shylock play. I'm curious to know what is particular about her production of Merchant of Venice, and also how it shows Shakespeare's philo-Semitism and also the relation with the British Empire.
Yes, Julia's production of Merchant of Venice, which is in fact an adaptation, which she called the Shylock play, was staged at the Arcola Theatre in London in 2007. And the most original element in her adaptation of Merchant is the addition of a new character called Sarah. Sarah is a Holocaust survivor. And this character was played by Ruth Posner, a real life survivor who escaped from the Warsaw ghetto, age 12. And Giulia's production starts as Sarah is about to be shown around the Venetian ghetto. And the tour, though, never gets underway because the water starts to rise and Sarah and her tour guide get stranded. And again, stranded with a company of actors who cannot get to the theater and so decide to start rehearsing Merchant of Venice then and there. So this is a framing device. And this framing device allows Sarah to comment on the Shakespearean play. But most importantly, he layered the theatrical space. So he added a temporal dimension to the fictive world of Shakespeare's play. And this way, Giulia prevented problematic lines or problematic moments in the play, including first and foremost the trial scene, from amounting to a unified scapegoating of Shylock. In other words, through Sarah, as played by Ruth Posner, Giulia evoked real life memories of the Holocaust, which in turn diffused a potentially possible anti-Semitic reading of the play.
Another chapter is about Henry V again. I think it's one of the most popular Shakespeare's plays that has been used in times of war, maybe. And the title, it's an interview with Nicholas Heitner. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing the name correctly. But anyway, so it's called May I With Right and Conscience Make This Claim? Testing the Just War Tradition in Nicholas Heitner's Henry V. I think this play was written in the wake of US and UK war against Iraq in 2003. So how does the production of Henry V here show opposition to this war? And the second part of my question is if this play has always been used to support, show support for British war, or has this tradition changed, as in this case?
So Nick Heitner's production was actually planned in early 2002. So that was before the war. But Heitner wanted to do the play because he felt that there could be a demand for a play that would be discussing war and its reasons and justification. But by the time the rehearsal period began, I mean, rehearsals began the day before the US and the UK announced that they would bypass the UN Security Council and go to war with in Iraq. So the rehearsal process and the beginning of the production very much coincided with the start of the war in Iraq. And that became a vital part of the actor's process and the production itself. And as Nick was explaining to us, what was most vivid about Henry V in the context of the Iraq War was not so much the staging of combat, but the reasons for war, how war is justified, how stories about war can be spun. Throughout the production, they included nods to the contemporary conflict. Perhaps the most obvious example is the very beginning of the production, where in the first act, Henry and it has to decide whether he has the right to invade France, whether he has a claim to the French throne. And at this moment in the production, Nick and his team had a prop which was made to resemble the dossier, or what was often called Alistair Campbell's dodgy dossier in the context of the Iraq War, which was supposedly contained evidence of Saddam Hussein's weapons of mass destruction. So this was deliberately designed as a prop that would prompt audiences to make that connection between something that was being discussed in 2003. and this moment from a 16th century play about a 15th century conflict, when there's this similar spinning of evidence of claims to justify invasion. And there were other moments throughout the play that also tapped into political spin, use of modern technologies that made a connection between the production and the Iraq context a significant and vital one. I think one example that Nick gives us in the interview itself, which I think is a really revealing one, is when he describes how he encountered Tony Blair at a reception a few years later, and Blair said, you know, to Nick, you know, you've been giving us a really hard time, haven't you? So in reference to the productions that were being staged at the National Theatre that could be read as taking an anti-war stance, and Blair sort of added, but it's your job to do that, and Nick sort of says this is a kind of an acknowledgement of the contemporary application of these plays, but he also felt that this was a way of, in his words, you know, turning me into a court jester. So in that sense, having the kind of the license to critique, but then maybe to what extent is a play that takes this kind of stance actually able to maybe prompt change or revision or to persuade? And I think that also taps into a wider point about a play like Henry V, and to draw on the second part of your question, what is the history of this play and how it's been used to support or reveal opposition to war? I mean, Henry V within this play can be seen as a charismatic leader. He can also be seen as a warmonger. And this play, throughout its publication and production history, has been used in different ways. During the Seven Years' War, there's a very a long run of this play that was clearly trying to suggest that this is a celebratory account of war. That was sitting alongside Britain's successes and acquisition of new colonies. At other times, it's been used to challenge that view. We can obviously thinking of Laurence Olivier's World War II cinematic adaptation that presented a sort of airbrushed Henry that cut out some of the dialogue and rhetoric that maybe detracted from or offered a more troubling representation of Henry's character. But I think one of the things that is important to consider with this play, it's not just recently that we have critical interpretations, but I think they have been an important part of this play's of discussion of this play and productions of it for centuries.
And the last chapter we're going to discuss is another interview with Iqbal Khan and his production of Othello. The chapter is called "Thou Hast Set Me on the Rack: Torture and Modern Warfare in Iqbal Khan's Othello." So, and again, I did not know him, so it would be great if you could briefly introduce him and tell us about his production of Othello in 2015. And apparently, and I'm curious to know, how does he depict racial relation in this production as opposed to Shakespeare? And he makes references to the torture of prisoners by Allied forces. How does that work in the play, and how does it make the audience reinterpret Othello in this new light?
Yes, so Khan cast two black actors, Hugh Quarshie and Lucian Msamati, to play Othello and Iago in this Royal Shakespeare Company production of Othello. And he therefore automatically departed from the Shakespearean original and from long established ways of juxtaposing these two characters racially. and along traditional lines of interpretation, which identify Black with monstrous otherness and white with a racial, but also with a moral norm as the standard condition of being human. But Kahn went further than this by showing how it is the bond between Othello and Iago as two military men, which rests on absolute trust, on watching each other's backs when confronted by the life-threatening challenges posed by combat, which makes Othello vulnerable to Iago's manipulation. So this is the military context within which Kahn sets Othello that provides an explanation for Othello's tragic misjudgment of Desdemona that has nothing to do with the color of his skin. What also made Kahn's production really interesting, and to address the second part of your question, is the way in which Kahn also makes Othello both complicit and at the same time a victim of the type of warfare that he's involved with. So Othello resorts to torture to subdue control and to extract information from his prisoners of war. And these torture scenes evoked the recent context of the Iraq War and the unfortunate, sad association of these scenes with Abu Ghraib and other American prisons in Iraq, how the detainees were treated in those prisons. And at the same time, Othello is deprived of agency by this type of warfare, modern warfare, which is often a proxy war. And by that, we mean a type of war where third parties fight or support directly or indirectly those at war with each other. And this type of war, and this is something that came up really clearly and poignantly during our interview with Iqbal Kahn, is that the it complicates the legal and moral sense of individual and collective responsibility. And the so-called rules of engagement have changed so much that it is all too easy for individuals to lose sight of where they fit in. It's easier to lose sight of system of values that applied more readily to all the methods of warfare. This, I think, is what made that production resonate incredibly powerfully in the aftermath of the Iraq War.
Professor Amy Litza and Professor Sonia Masai, I can't thank you enough for talking to us on New Books Network about your wonderful collection of essays on Shakespeare. I do strongly recommend this book to listeners. As I said, it's not only a collection of scholarly essays, but they also get to know a lot about the British dramas and more contemporary playwrights. So the book is called Shakespeare at War and Material History, published in 2023 by Cambridge University Press. Thank you very, very much for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you.